Okay, and so on page 106, we're going to start back with our review today for exam four. Just going to work you forward here from filtration on the glomerulus. Okay, so the process of filtration is a process where we take the tiny stuff out of the bloodstream and we look at it and we say, is this something we want to keep and reabsorb? Or is this something we don't want to reabsorb and we just want to let go in the urine? So I kind of equate filtration to the process of dumping your book bag or your purse and then looking at all the items inside and deciding what you want to keep versus what you want to toss. In fact, when you do dump your book bag or your purse, you probably do keep most of the items in there. You only discard the trash or the waste products that you want to get rid of. So I think of the process of filtration as that decision-making process that your body goes through in deciding what to keep, reabsorb, versus what to continue let to travel through your renal tubule and get rid of. So the only small stuff should pass through a filtration membrane on your glomerulus. Big stuff like blood cells and blood proteins should not pass through the filtration membrane. Therefore, we should never see these big items in the filtrate. We should only see the tiny items, dissolved substances in our blood plasma. So good stuff, like electrolytes, blood glucose, sodium, even small things like amino acids may end up in our filtrate, but we reabsorb 99% of what we filter because, you know, this is a decision process of deciding what we want to keep versus toss. So this is your glomerulus. This is the location where filtration occurs. And in order to perform filtration, we have to maintain proper blood pressure. So pressure is going to be required to push the fluids out and then capture them by this capsule. We don't want them to be reabsorbed back in because that would defeat the whole purpose of filtering out that blood. So we have to have a high enough pressure to continually force out those fluids and solutes and not let them escape back into the blood supply. Not yet. We want to take them through PCT first. Okay, so to filter, we have to have a high enough blood pressure. BHP, or hydrostatic pressure, is in fact the same thing as blood pressure. And so you'll notice it's around 55 millimeters mercury. Osmotic pressure, a little high here. You know, normally we talked about it being 26. So it's pulling back in with a pressure of 30. Any escaped fluids that are pushed out into your Bowman's capsule are also creating hydrostatic pressure. They're sitting out here in this space, and they're forcing pressure back into those capillaries. So when we do the math here, 55 minus 30 minus 15 gives us an overall net filtration pressure of 10. So as long as you're pushing hard enough to get those fluids and solutes out, we can form a product that we call filtrate. So filtrate is what's captured by the capsule and then sent downward into that PCT. Okay, so if you don't have high enough filtration pressure, we don't get all those waste products out of the bloodstream and they can continue to travel in our blood. So if blood pressure is too low, let's talk about back here a little bit. These special set of cells here will detect the low blood pressure, and what chemical do they release? Renin, that's right. Renin travels to the liver. The liver now releases? Good, angiotensin 1. What converts it to 2?
ACE.
ACE, good. So ACE stands for angiotensin converting enzyme. Angiotensin 2 is a really potent vasoconstrictor. Something I didn't really mention to you earlier is this. Angiotensin 2 will actually come and squeeze your efferent arteriole, making it harder for the blood to escape your glomerulus. That helps to maintain pressure in your glomerulus and helps you continue to make filtrate. All right, so the next step is angiotensin 2 then turns on two hormones. What are they? And ADH, good. Which one of those retains sodium and water? Aldosterone, right. And water only is, of course, ADH. So by retaining water, we can increase blood pressure. That increase in blood pressure will help us to maintain filtrate formation. And the whole goal here is to remove those waste products from the bloodstream during filtration. So filtration, we got to keep in mind, is a way to remove blood plasma, solutes, the good and the bad, but not the big items like the blood cells or the plasma proteins. Okay, so a couple of other things to mention here. We also look at the filtration rate. That is the speed at which the kidneys filter the blood. We're looking at a filtration rate of around 120 milliliters per minute. So that is as fast as the kidneys operate. If you flood your system with a bunch of fluids, you're still not going to operate faster than 120 milliliters per minute. But if you're operating slower than that, what is the risk that we run? Yeah, kidneys may be keeping all those toxins and waste products, right? So if you're at half of that at 60, then we're now looking at kidney disease, and all the way down to 15, we look at then kidney failure. So the filtration rate means that we're capable of removing those waste products during filtration. Okay, so NFP is 10. That's the power or the push behind this blood plasma. And the rate that we filter at is the GFR. That stands for glomerular filtration rate. It's around 120 milliliters per minute. Okay, so that more or less recaps page 106. Keep going, page 107. Okay. So what we push out of the glomerular capillaries is now called filtrate. Even though it used to be blood plasma, it's now in a different location, so we call it filtrate. That filtrate travels into the Bowman's capsule, and then it travels into the PCT, which is our first twisty tube exiting off of that glomerulus. In the PCT, we're going to reclaim a lot of items whether or not we need them. Any item you reclaim moves back into these peritubular capillaries, over to that venule, to the cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, where's next? Interlobar, and then renal, right.
Okay, so what about the stuff that wasn't able to be in the capsule? Does that just go straight to the peritubule instead of the PCT?
Yeah, if it's not filtered, let's say if it's a red blood cell, for instance, if it wasn't filtered, it travels to the efferent arteriole, and then it's in the peritubular capillaries.
Okay, so it goes to the efferent first.
Yeah.
But the stuff that is filtered doesn't go to the efferent, it just goes straight to the PCT.
That's correct. Uh-huh. That's right. Natalie. If you're talking like a red blood cell, it'll come all the way to the glomerulus. It doesn't get filtered. It travels to the efferent arteriole, to the peritubular capillaries, and then it just keeps on going back in the blood supply.
So is there, like, so I guess what would go through the whole process and still exit the
efferent? You mean not being filtered?
Yeah.
If it's in the efferent arteriole, it was not filtered. Okay, so that includes blood cells and blood proteins, and anything else that just didn't get squeezed out. Yeah, so big stuff and whatever just didn't get removed. Okay, how about other questions? These are good questions. Okay, so let's take something like a glucose molecule. Glucose is one of those things in the blood plasma. It's a solute that's going to be filtered out at the glomerulus. So we come from the renal artery all the way to the afferent arteriole. When we travel through the glomerulus, that glucose molecule is then filtered and removed from the bloodstream. Because it's filtered, that's our clue word there, we are now captured by the capsule and we travel into the PCT. You've got two options here. If it's a glucose molecule, you can let it keep rotting. It can continue traveling from the PCT, down the loop of Henle, up the DCT, over here to the collecting duct and be removed in your urine. That's a potential pathway for glucose to take. But we're going to keep up to how many units of glucose?
180.
180, right. So if you've got up to 180 units of glucose, we do reabsorb it in the PCT back into these peritubular capillaries. Those peritubular capillaries then join the venule, cortical radiate vein, and then we're back into blood flow. So technically, items that are filtered have two potential pathways, just continue on in the renal tubule to become urine or get reabsorbed back into the bloodstream to be kept. Okay, so in fact, glucose is an important one. If it remains in the tubule system, it pulls water with it, and it lets the water leave the body. That's what we call an osmotic diuretic. Okay, sodium, chlorine, we take those back whether or not we need them. We consider those to be necessary, so we do reclaim most of those from the blood filter, or from the filtrate back into the blood. We do reclaim bicarbonate. The more of it we take back or reabsorb, what happens to your blood pH?
Goes up,
right, because it's basic. It makes your blood more alkaline. The water reabsorption here, you'll notice, is not hormonally driven. So this water reabsorption is obligatory. It means we take it whether or not we need it. And then amino acids are taken here because obviously those build what? Proteins, yeah. So this stuff here is all good stuff. We're going to take it whether or not we need it. We just reabsorb it automatically back into the peritubular capillaries. Okay. Any questions on the PCT and its role in reabsorption? So where does countercurrent multiplication take place? Nephron loop, yeah, both ascending and descending. So in the descending limb of the nephron loop, we only reabsorb water, while in the ascending limb, we reabsorb only sodium and chlorine. We do not let water follow salt this time. We actually separate the two, and that's very important because we are trying to make sure the filtrate is the right level of saltiness. If it's too salty or not salty enough, this can create a fluid electrolyte imbalance. So the countercurrent multiplication process that occurs here is all about maintaining the salinity or saltiness of your bloodstream. Okay, so keep in mind water flows down in the descending limb. That's how we reabsorb. Sodium and chlorine are reabsorbed in the ascending limb going up. Any questions on nephron loop's job?
Okay, when you mentioned a countercurrent multiplication, so you don't refer to it as the loop of Henle, you just refer to it as descending and ascending loop?
You can call it ascending, descending portions, limbs, or you can call it just the nephron loop or loop of Henle.
Okay.
The important thing is to know that it takes that process, countercurrent, takes place in that loop. Do you have other questions on anything on page 107? Okay, let's go to page 108, and here we're going to talk about tubular reabsorption in the DCT. By the way, I'm going to pass around the attendance roster. If you would like to take the test early tomorrow, Friday, in the assessment center, just make me a note on here.
What if we're not sure? I'm kind of seeing how the next couple of days go, and then I may take it Friday, so I'll just stick it in there anyway.
Yeah, let me stick it in there. It's no harm for me to put a copy over there. So if you think at all you might want it Friday, yeah, just put a note on there for me. Thanks. Okay, so when we get to the DCT, we are now at a place where your body has to reclaim things using hormones. If these hormones aren't present, then we're not going to reabsorb these items into the bloodstream. They're going to leave in the urine. So I think of the DCT as a place where we have hormonal-driven reabsorption. So if aldosterone is present, that means we must have had low what? Low blood pressure. Good. What else might necessitate aldosterone being there? Low blood volume, and one more, low blood sodium. Yeah, so any of those three might necessitate aldosterone being present at the DCT: low blood sodium, low blood volume, low blood pressure, or even high blood potassium. So any of those stimuli might encourage aldosterone to insert sodium channels. Sodium, of course, is reabsorbed and water follows. So if you've got a problem or an imbalance we're trying to correct, aldosterone will help to reclaim sodium in water. What kind of conditions might we have if ADH is present?
Dehydration.
Dehydration, right. So low blood volume again, low amount of water, blood that is too salty. So we could reclaim water only using ADH and aquaporins in that DCT region. Because ADH helps reabsorb water, we call this facultative reabsorption. Let me contrast that with here in the PCT, that is called obligatory reabsorption. Okay, so if you're obliged to go to a birthday party, you gotta do it, right? So obligatory means you must reabsorb water. That's gonna take it whether or not you need it in the PCT. Okay, contrast that with the DCT. This water is only reabsorbed if you need it under the direction of ADH. Okay, and then finally, PTH is going to drive calcium reabsorption. What must the calcium imbalance be?
Too low.
Too low, right. Okay, so let's take an example. Let's take sodium on a tour. Let's start with the renal artery. Let's take it from the renal artery, segmental artery. What's next? Interlobar. Afferent arteriole, and then glomerulus. Good. Let's filter it. So where does it go next? Bowman's capsule. Good. And then where?
DCT.
Well, PCT, loop of Henle, right? And then let's take it to the DCT. If aldosterone is sitting there, what happens to the sodium? Reabsorb, good. So that means it moves into
blood,
peritubular capillaries, good. And then from there, we travel through the venule, we go through this cortical radiate vein, arcuate vein, back to the interlobar, and then one more,
renal.
Okay, so if you do reabsorb it here under the direction of aldosterone, that's its pathway. Hey, what if there's no aldosterone? What happens to that sodium in the DCT? Flush it out in the urine, right. So it travels to the collecting duct. It travels from there to the renal papilla, minor calyces, major calyces, renal pelvis. Where's next? Ureter,
bladder,
urethra. Okay, so you basically have two options. You can either reabsorb that sodium under the direction of aldosterone in the DCT or flush it out in the urine. I did want to mention that there are some things that interfere with reabsorption, especially in the DCT. Alcohol prevents ADH from inserting aquaporin water channels. So water that's present in the DCT is not reabsorbed. So what pathway does it take from the DCT? Does it go blood flow or does it go urine? Goes to the urine, right. So alcohol allows water to be flushed out in the urine. Diuretics like Lasix and caffeine both inhibit sodium reabsorption in the DCT. So what hormone are they manipulating? Aldosterone, right. So if you're not reabsorbing sodium, where does that sodium go? Out in the urine, yep. And of course, we've talked about glucose. Glucose can also draw water out into your urine, causing glucose or glycosuria. And of course, that dehydrates us when that fluid leaves with our sugar molecules. So these are some things that can interfere with the reabsorptive process. Okay, so that kind of resums up page 108. How about questions on that page?
The other day you were saying something how, like you said, let's just skip something and go to the DCT, like
secretion probably.
Okay, maybe that's what.
That might be it, because that's actually our next one.
Okay.
If it's not, if it doesn't sound familiar, let me know. Okay, so our last process is page 109. This is called tubular secretion. So let's take a molecule of, say, some hydrogen ions. Those hydrogen ions may start out in the renal artery, segmental artery, interlobar artery, where's next? Arcuate, cortical radiate, afferent arteriole, glomerulus. We're not going to filter it, so where does it go?
Efferent.
Yeah, efferent or efferent arteriole.
Peritubular
capillaries. Okay, now your body says, oh, hey, let's put some aldosterone at the DCT. Aldosterone is going to drive potassium to be secreted. So what this means is we're going to move from the peritubular capillaries with this potassium and or hydrogen, whichever it may be, and then we move those items into the DCT. And now what is their ultimate destination? Blood or urine? Thanks.
Urine,
yeah. So if you secrete these items at the DCT from the peritubular capillaries, their destination is urine. So aldosterone drives potassiums and hydrogens from the bloodstream into the filtrate. That means they move from the peritubular capillaries into the DCT, and those items travel now in the tubule from the DCT over to the collecting duct, and we drip from the renal papilla into minor and major calyces, renal pelvis, and so forth. So those secreted items move from the bloodstream. It's late in the game, but they move from the bloodstream into the tubule system to be excreted as urine. So if we have high counts of, say, hydrogen ions in the bloodstream, acidosis, that is a good reason to dump and get rid of those hydrogens. If you have high levels of potassium, that can cause heart arrhythmias. That is also a good reason to get rid of those potassiums. Dump those and secrete them. Urea, uric acid, and creatinine are waste products of metabolism, either nucleic acid or muscle metabolism. They may have been filtered and reabsorbed, but ultimately your body may say, hey, this is trash, this is a waste product, so let's secrete it and get rid of it in the urine pathway. So the thing to remember is that reabsorption reclaims items into the bloodstream. It is the exact opposite of secretion, which moves items from the bloodstream into what? Into the urine, yeah. So they're moving in opposite directions here. So secretion is a process that we get rid of waste products that perhaps were not filtered in the first place. Okay. So just wanted to kind of hit that page for you. That's page 109. How about questions on that one? Okay. Page 110 actually has answers on D2L, and we did page 111 together in here. Any questions on those two pages? Do you have any questions on 112 through 114? Have you had a chance to read through those yet? Okay.
For 114, there's two blanks. Would the first one be the inflammation?
That's right. And diabetes insipidus? No ADH. Yeah.
The ADH.
Right. So yeah, glomerulonephritis is inflammation of the glomerulus, and diabetes insipidus is insufficient ADH. And the four tracings that you guys have are the bottom of 105. But yeah, you'll want to know, if I say filtered or secreted, you'll want to know exactly where we're going.
Anytime something has been filtered and in the bloodstream, it has to go back from the peritubular to the DCT. If it's going to be secreted.
Yeah, if it's secreted, peritubular to DCT. That's right. Kayla. That's right. You could pick those and just leave everything else alone. Yeah, so you could certainly do that.
Are those the highest?
They are four pointers. So, yeah, they're the highest. I think I might have a five pointer, but I don't remember. I might, let me look.
And there's tracing from the reabsorption, secretion, and then from the renal artery to the renal vein.
Yeah, it's 1 through 4 on the bottom of that 105 page. I've got 3 of those 4 on there for you. Sure. Yeah, Erica, those are all 4 pointers.
The tracings.
The tracings, yeah.
Okay.
What's that?
I
actually don't have a 5 pointer this time. I put all 4 tracings, as all 3 tracings as 4 pointers. Okay. There's 2 other essays on there, so if you don't want to do a tracing, you can pick one. One is a fluid electrolyte problem. I'm trying to think what the other one was. One is a kidney issue and one is a electrolyte balance problem. Okay, so to do the glucose tracing, let's start with the renal artery. From the renal artery, we travel through segmental artery. What's next? And then?
Arcuate, corticobranchial,
okay. Afferent, arteriole,
glomerulus,
and since it's filtered?
Bowman's capsule.
Bowman's capsule. And then it goes into the
PCT.
PCT, good. Now reabsorb it, so it goes into the?
Peritubular capillaries.
Good. Peritubular capillaries to the venule, to the?
Radiate.
Cortical radiate, good.
Arcuate.
Interlobar.
And renal vein.
You got it, good. From the cortical radiate artery to the arcuate, interlobar, then renal vein. Okay.
I think what's confusing me is it's just going to be reabsorbed and go back into the bloodstream, but it can go, it's only going to go to the DCT if you say there's like aldosterone or, you know what I'm saying? Like that tracing, we're just taking it from the Bowman's capsule to the PCT and then the peritubular capillaries.
Right.
But so when is it going to go to the peritubular capillaries and through the loop to the DCT? Is that only when there's aldosterone and ADA?
Let's see, if you're going PCT to the loop to the DCT, I would have to be very specific in saying we didn't get reabsorbed and we're still in the tubule.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. I was like, how will we know?
I'd have to tell you that we have aldosterone present, and then you'd know, okay, that's
DCT. So we got to go to the DCT.
Yeah.
And then we would go to the, if it's secreted from the DCT,
if it's secreted, if you're in the bloodstream, then you're moving peritubular into the DCT.
And then when you get to the efferent, though, that's if you're not being reabsorbed. You get from
not being filtered.
Filtered, that's what I mean.
Yes, if you're not filtered and you're in the efferent arteriole, you can end up in the peritubular capillaries, and the only option for you is to now be secreted. Yeah.
So it's going to go from the glomerulus to the efferent, and then the peritubular capillaries,
right.
And then secreted out, like, so it will go peritubular capillaries to the collect.
Does
it go to the collecting duct?
You can go to the collecting duct or DCT. Those are common secretion sites.
Okay.
It's a lot to keep track of here.
Are you really specific on numbers, like how much urine is produced?
I would know that we make about 1.5 liters of urine a day. I would know our total exchangeable fluids per day is 2.5 liters. The kidneys are the number one route for fluid loss. I wouldn't worry about skin and lungs and feces in terms of their volumes, but the main ones are per day is 1.5, 2.5 for an entire exchange of fluids.
Do we need to know the
for GFR, I know that number, and I know NFP is 10 millimeters mercury. Yeah. Usually it's not bad. It's usually about an endocrine is usually the lower test scores, digestive your respiratory or lower test scores. This one tends to hit back up where the cardiovascular does on average. So it doesn't knock the grades tremendously. I have sometimes had people where they're kind of just burned out and they don't really have time to study. I do see a drop in their grades, but if you're able to maintain your study habits throughout this last part, then it seems to be okay. I know a lot of people get really busy this time of the semester and just don't have time to dedicate like they do during the rest. What is your next question? Is there anything on urinary that we can go back through that I can help you with? Anything on fluid electrolyte? Sure. Okay, so this information is pages 122 and 123. We're going to talk about types of dehydration. During osmosis, isotonic solutions don't really cause an overall net change in cell size or shape. Hypotonic solutions make cells bloat, and hypertonic solutions make cells shrivel. So if we keep that stuff in mind that we already know, we can apply it to this type of dehydration information here. What we're looking at when we think about dehydration is what are we losing? And we look at the primary thing that we're losing that creates the imbalance. You can totally overthink this. You can totally take this to another level of how it influences other pressures, but we're going to stick just with the primary thing that we're losing. With isotonic dehydration, look for the clue words, equal or same loss of water and electrolytes, or it may say water, salts, and proteins. But the clue word here is we're losing equal amounts of those items. If you lose equal amounts of water, solutes, and proteins, there is no net shift in the overall fluid flow. So you're still filtering fluids out to the interstitial space from the bloodstream, and you're still able to reabsorb those fluids back in at the venule end of your capillaries. So overall, we don't see a massive change in how it influences cells and the interstitial space. This is, you know, a couple of one-off instances, diarrhea, vomiting, fasting, or bleeding that can lead to isotonic dehydration, okay? So clue words here are equal or same loss of salts, solutes, fluids, proteins. Okay. How about questions on isotonic? The catch with hypotonic dehydration is what you're losing. I'm going to have to give you clues, and the clue on the test is going to be either salt, solutes, proteins, electrolytes. So when we think about those items, they contribute to a particular pressure in the blood. What pressure is that?
Osmotic.
Osmotic, right. So when you see the clue that says we're losing salt, solutes, electrolytes, proteins, you say, ah, that's my clue for BOP is being lost. So in this scenario, we're losing those particular items more so than water from the bloodstream. And so you'll notice that with almost every scenario here, we're looking at some type of imbalance to the salt, protein, solutes, or electrolytes in the bloodstream. Since we're losing those solutes or proteins, the BOP is lost, and we can't reclaim fluids in during reabsorption at the venule end of the capillary. So in thinking about our blood flow here, at the arterial end of our capillary, we force fluids out into the interstitial space thanks to hydrostatic pressure. Normally, blood osmotic pressure pulls the fluids back in. But since we don't have enough blood osmotic pressure to pull those fluids, they continue to accumulate in the interstitial space. What does that cause?
Edema.
Good. Now, if that fluid is hypertonic in nature, and it quite likely is, the fluids now continue traveling on into your cells. So your cells, as a result, will bloat or swell when we have not enough proteins and solutes to return the fluid back in the bloodstream. Okay, so this one is hypotonic. And that comes from a loss of blood osmotic pressure. Okay, so I'm going to have to give you a clue, and the clue is going to be loss of salt, solutes, proteins, or electrolytes. How about questions on hypotonic dehydration? Okay, so hypertonic dehydration is actually an imbalance where we have not enough fluid to balance the sodium in our bloodstream or proteins in our bloodstream. So the imbalance creates a loss of fluids from the blood, and so that loss of fluids leads to a loss of particular pressure called what?
Hydrostatic.
Hydrostatic, right. So when you lose hydrostatic pressure, how does that influence the push-pull filtration reabsorption process?
Push.
You're not able to push the fluids out. So since we're not able to filter the fluids out, but we are still able to reabsorb, what happens to the fluid compartments around the capillary? They shrivel up, right. So during this scenario, here's our capillary, there's our interstitial space. We start pulling from the interstitial space back into the capillary, those fluids, and we start to dehydrate that area. When that fluid compartment becomes hypertonic, we then start pulling fluids out of our intracellular compartment. So the intracellular compartment then becomes shriveled. So in this setup, we actually are pulling more fluids back into the capillary than we are actually pushing out into that space. So when you think about being dehydrated and shriveled, this is what we normally think of. It's called hypertonic dehydration. So in these scenarios here, you'll notice that we have usually a loss of fluids, like with these two forms of diabetes or with sweating. But you'll notice that we can also experience an increase in salt. An increase in salt causes the same problem as a loss of fluid. The imbalance is we're reabsorbing more than we can filter out in the first place. So keep in mind that with this scenario, an increase in BOP works the same way as a loss of BHP. Okay? So just something to kind of keep in mind. But our perspective here is one of loss or dehydration. So technically, it's the loss of BHP that causes the setup for this problem. Okay. So our perspective for all three scenarios, iso, hypo, and hyper, is dehydration is some form of a loss. Okay. So clue words to look for here is loss of water from the bloodstream or something that induces loss of fluids into the urine. How about questions on hypertonic dehydration? Okay, how are you with hypotonic hydration on the next page, 123?
You said the BOP is osmotic, right?
BOP is osmotic, that's right. So tell me what we're doing with hypotonic hydration. Are we losing or are we gaining?
Gaining,
good. So what exactly are we gaining, water or salt?
Water.
Water, right. And if you get a bunch of extra water, the little bit of salt you do have becomes diluted, and so you're unable again to return fluids back to the bloodstream. So does it mostly match our hypertonic or our hypotonic dehydration scenario? Matches our hypotonic. So we don't look at the hydration issue from a perspective of what are we losing. We look at it from a perspective as what are we gaining. And since we're gaining fluids, we say that we actually increase our BHP. So most of our scenarios are dehydration scenarios because we're constantly battling losing fluids or losing salts or proteins. So that's our perspective here is what are we losing? It's a dehydration event. Okay, How about questions on pages 122 or 123? So we worked a number of problems together on Monday on page 124. 125 does have answers, but I wanted to ask, did you have any questions on any of those problems, 124 or 125? And the way I break it down, multiple choice, is I'll say to you, we've got somebody who has lost, saw use, what pressure is lost? So that's one question. Another question may say, we've lost BHP, what kind of dehydration do we have? So I'll pinpoint certain aspects of those questions, and I'll give you a scenario and ask you what we're dealing with. Okay. Mm-hmm. Or if I say to you, hey, we've lost salts and proteins, we've got X problem, then you'll say, okay, that's hypotonic, yeah.
But do you tend to
more
lean towards the hyper and hypo, isotonic?
I don't usually ask iso, yeah. I usually ask hyper and hypo. I'll ask you what pressure is affected. I'll ask you to name the type of disorder. And I'll probably ask you to tell me how the fluids flow, whether it's out into the interstitial space and cap cell, or if it's back into the capillary. But I'll set up the problem for you, see, kind of see where I'm heading with it. Old tests have really good suggestions. Yep. All right, how about any other questions with fluid electrolyte? It is. It's pretty split even, yeah. Y'all feeling the nervous energy of the last of the semester hitting you? Yeah.
Yeah, tests in every class.
Yeah, you just can't catch a break. Hyponatremia, you'd say, ah, that's not enough sodium. Yeah. Or I may say to you, what's the most common ion in the entire body? Calcium. And I pretty much have an even spread among each chapter. We covered like 10, 11 chapters, no more than 10 or 11 questions on the entire reproductive system. Some of it is anatomy that you guys have hit in lab, and a little bit is physiology that we'll do here, probably next Wednesday here in lecture. Yeah, we'll do it next Wednesday. I'm not going to cover anatomy since I'd be double doing what lab's done, but I will do the physiology for you. Yeah. Can I help you work any problems, any discussion questions in there that you're looking at, anything I can help you work through?